Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello. 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 Hello and welcome to Caged In. This is another one of our bonus Caged In conversations where I sit down and speak to somebody who has worked with Nicolas Cage. On this episode, I get someone who's not worked with him not once, not twice, but three times. I get to speak to editor Brett W. Buckman, who's worked with Nicolas Cage on Mandy, Color Out of Space, and Pig, which is released today, if you're listening to this day of release, in the US, and is released in the UK on the 20th of August. So it is very much in our crosshairs, and it's a fantastic film. It's not like it's up there, not only being my favourite Nicolas Cage film of the year, possibly my favourite film of the year. It's a beautiful, poetic film that has this fantastic, fascinating meta-narrative that I'll get into later on down the podcast when I eventually cover this film in all its gory details. But for now, yeah, listen to this conversation with Brett Buckman. It's an amazing conversation. We get into some stuff that I've never heard before in regards to some of these films. Not that any of it's libelous or anything like that. Just, yeah, Brett was amazingly generous with his time and just the stories he told me. And I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. There's mention of Daniel Noah in this conversation, you may remember from a previous Caged In conversation. But yeah, if this is your first time listening, do be sure to check out that, because there's a lot of crossover. Daniel is a producer on both Mandy and Color Out of Space, so that may pique your interests. But there's plenty of fantastic Caged In conversations, and I'll talk about a few in the outro. I imagine a lot of you listening to this might already be regular listeners. So yeah, drop in at the end if you want to get some recommendations of other great conversations I've had with some fantastic people. But until then, enjoy this conversation with Brett W. Buckman. One last thing before you enjoy this week's episode. There are some spoilers for Pig, but me and Brett do signpost them before we get into them, so it shouldn't ruin the episode. And this is kind of done in a kind of career chronological order, so it will go Mandy, Color Out of Space, and then Pig. So there's plenty of listen to before you duck out of that part. I totally understand if you want to go into that film as fresh as possible, and I would very much recommend it. So yeah, if you're going to not listen to all of this episode, I totally understand it, but there is plenty to enjoy in the meantime. I have the pleasure of being joined by an editor, producer, actor, and somebody who's possibly looked at Nick Cage's face for more hours than even me, Brett Buckman. How are you, Brett?
Hi, man. I am doing very well. Such a joy to be here.
How is it like, kind of, you've got Pig coming out, which I would have talked about in the intro. And I think the first question I kind of want to ask you is, you're like the through line, basically, of what I'm calling like the Nickonnaissance. Like, if you kind of look at these, like, there's these three big Nick Cage movies where it's like the early 2010s, everybody are like, he's fallen off. And then there's these ones that seeing him like claw back into popular favor. And you seem to be involved in all three of them. How does that feel?
That's really cool. It's how else do other to express it? It's a combination of being in the right place at the right time. It's been an absolute pleasure to work with someone like Nick, you know, time and time again. And you never really know what he's going to do.
Yeah.
The amount of precision this guy has, I will say he's never boring to work with. He's never boring to watch. And it's so far, it's been the distinction of my career so far. You know, I'm 19 features in, but hoping I can do more with him.
Perfect. Well, before we kind of get into like a Nick Cage rabbit hole too deep, where did you like start off as an editor? Where did you like, what made you think this is what I want to do?
Yeah. I had started way back in high school. We have this thing, you do your senior year of high school called the Senior Project, which is, you know, this 20-hour, you have to put 20 hours into this product for this career fair you make. And I thought I was going down a medicine path. I thought I wanted to kind of follow into becoming a doctor, but I was playing high school football at the time. And a friend had me over one day and he showed me this wrestling highlight video that someone had made in his school district. And it had had interviews with the team. It had had these little vignettes. It had had footage throughout the year. And it just kind of had like this the fact that, you know, a 17-year-old had made this 15 to 20 minute thing. And this is, mind you, this is like way back in 2003 when edit cameras and editing equipment like weren't really everywhere. And it got me really excited about the possibility of me doing something like that for the team I was playing on. And I was able to kind of set up this documentary of sorts. And so I got all the appropriate permission from my coach and from, I was able to borrow a video camera and started shooting everything behind the scenes, some practice footage, some just random interactions throughout the spring of my junior year, going into summer camp. During games, I would obtain footage from people up in the stands, from the high school video production squad down in the field. And after months and months of doing this, had tons of footage. We ended up winning league that year for the first time in like, you know, years and years. And sat down in front of Final Cut Pro 5, which I'd never really used before, and kind of taught myself how to edit on the senior project thing. Long story short, at the end of, came in every single day at the end of school, edited until like 7 or 8 every single night. And then when the movie was done, had a little mini premiere in the school's auditorium in March. Probably one of the more influential dates of my entire life. Came into school the next day, sat in front of my EMAC where I'd edited this thing in the video production lab, and just wished I had something else to work on, something else to do. And that was kind of the genesis of it all. From there, I ended up switching what I wanted to do. I went to a little state school called Western Washington University up in Bellingham, Washington, got really involved in their a college TV program where I did a lot of sketch comedy. I was writing, I was acting, editing, directing. And after a few years of that, realizing that, yes, this is something I really want to be serious about, made the decision to start looking into film school. I wanted a very specific, traditional kind of academic environment to keep on with this, because Western really wasn't much, they didn't really have much in the way of a practical film program. And so it kind of came down between, that's kind of how I ended up over at AFI. And after spending 2.5 years at the program there and, you know, meeting friends all hopefully after the rest of my life and having some, I graduated that, and sputtered around Los Angeles for 2 years, kind of doing any single like little odd job I could. I was doing music videos. I was doing sketches for Funny or Die. I was doing things on spec. And I eventually got an email one night from a staff member at AFI. And occasionally they'll send out blasts of emails being like, hey, you know, so-and-so looking for an editor starts tomorrow. And I had my resume ready. I had my website ready. And this email blast comes out saying, low budget action horror movie looking for an editor starts next week. Sent in my resume, sent in everything, get a phone call the next day saying, hey, like your stuff. Come over to Burbank, meet us on set and, you know, do an interview. Amazing. And that ended up being Raise. That was my first feature. I ended up meeting a very special person in my life who really opened the door for my entire career. This guy named Josh Waller, who was the director on Raise, to this day, still one of my best friends. And that was the connection that led me into SpectreVision. And that I've done 9 films with the partners over SpectreVision now. And it's kind of where everything started for me.
So that relationship you have with SpectreVision, it's kind of like, when it comes to like pictures like Mandy, how did that come about? Did they kind of go like, we trust you from what you've done with like Cooties and stuff like that? You said in total you've made 9 features with them. How did the Mandy job come about?
Well, I had a really fortunate position with the partners where we had, Mandy was, I think, our 8th film we'd done together. Raise, Mechanic, Cooties, Max Rose, Camino, Bitch. It was like 6 or 7. And so usually I was the first one to get a script from, like, they weren't even really talking to a lot of other editors at that time. It was like Brett is up for this. If Brett passes, we'll go to somebody else. Yeah. But also, you know, hey, we need to maintain that this is someone the director wants to work with in the first place. And so, you know, it's not like I just get the job. It's like, we want to put Brett up for this. Let's have Brett meet with the director. Let's sure Brett and director get along. So that's how, you know, Bitch came about. That's how Cooties came about, you know, meeting with John and Carrie. That's how, you know, every single other relationship with the director I've had that Spectre has done. It's I meet with the director, make sure that we're on the same page about the movie, that we'll get, the chemistry is there, we're going to get along.
Yeah. What is your kind of ethos as to like what the editor's job is and how it like services the film? Because what I've noticed from watching a lot of your films this week is that you don't like, it's not like a distinct Brett Buckman style, as it were. Do you know what I mean? Like,
And I think that's how it should be. My ethos, it's just to support the director and to find the best movie with the production team. SpectreVision, in particular, are producers that get, you know, they have a particular brand, they have a movie they set out to make. You know, that's the reason the company was formed in the first place. They want to put certain movies out into the world. And so they are involved, I think, from a very big creative standpoint, but at the appropriate time. You know, we have our several weeks that, you know, the director and I will work together. We present an early cut. If we're trying to submit to Sundance or to another festival, get preliminary notes on that. And then eventually the producers are invited in to participate in the editing process. I've always saw myself as there for the director, there to make sure I get on the same page with the director, to make sure that what I am working on is the best movie in their head. And mind you, that sometimes that means challenging the director. Sometimes that means positioning other options. Sometimes that means, you know, playfully being a devil's advocate. You know, Mandy's a good reference where, you know, sometimes I would, you know, question, you know, pitch things to Panos, you know, whether it was scene compression or whether it was alternative options. And sometimes they just be like, no, that's not what I want. You know, I want to keep this scene the way it is, or I want to make this scene, you know, longer. It has to have a very particular rhythm. But I want to make sure that I'm welcomed by the director to be there, that I am entrusted with them, that I am working for them, and that I'm also working collaboratively with the producers when they come on board. I And so I don't think it's really appropriate for an editor to have a particular style because every single film requires a different, is a different creative beast. You know, it's a different, has different requirements, different genres require different tactics. You know, I just hope I can make the best movie possible with the team. You know, and that comes down to, a lot of it comes down to my early cuts with sensibilities and taste and rhythm and, you know, working with the material that is given to me by the production. And on some movies, fortunately, that sometimes that aligns really quickly. Like on Color Out of Space, for instance, there's a lot of scenes that appear in the final film, more or less identical to the assembly cut, like more or less identical to the first edit.
So yeah, back to Mandy, how did that project come about? Like, were they like, how does it tend to come about? Is it like the film's finished and then like they go, hey man, you come and edit this, or is it kind of what stage do they get you on?
Yeah. I was on set for another movie with them. We were shooting this movie called Bitch, and I had found out hanging out on set, grabbing footage one night, that they had locked in Cage. And it was a big deal. And they were going to go to the press with it pretty soon. And mind you, I don't hear a lot about, you know, things in development until they're like greenlit, they're ready to go, because, you know, Spectral will have, you know, any number of things in development at any given time. But this was a big deal for them. They're like, this is going to be one of the, probably the most high profile project we've done. Now that Cage is involved, I was being told about Panos. And then the project kind of went away for a few months. At least from my perspective, I went on to do another movie. It was ended up being really serious. They got greenlit. They had the money. They were going over to Belgium to start, location scouting and shooting. And then I heard through them that it would likely have to be a Belgium editor for tax reasons. They had a certain tax requirement that they needed for the rebate to spend a certain amount of money in Europe. And so it looked like this probably wouldn't happen for me, which sucked. Because it's everything they had told me from that initial pitch, Nick Cage, surreal, love story, barbarian movie set in the 80s, sounded like exactly my type of jam. And then it all kind of came, once it came together for me, it happened incredibly fast. I was on a commercial shoot on the East Coast. So this one particular morning, I had received the script. I had read the script a few weeks previous, just out of curiosity from them. And I was on a commercial shoot in Baltimore. We were on a field shooting an Under Armour commercial with a cross country group. And I was left behind to like guard everybody's personal, like all of the bags from like all of the high schoolers and like, Brett, watch the battery, sit here, don't move.
This isn't what I'm going for.
Yeah, so that's what I was doing. And then I get a text, and it's Josh Waller, you know, the head of production at Spectre, and he was like out there working with them. And he's like, can you Skype with Panos in 5 minutes?
Whoa.
And I'm in the middle of nowhere in a field in Baltimore, and I look, I have like three bars. I'm like 10% on my phone. I was like, yes, fuck it, let's do it. And sure enough, like he Skypes me in from his apartment in Belgium, and we just started talking about the movie. You know, exchange some pleasantries, talked about what they've been doing over there. They had been shooting for about, I think, 2 or 3 weeks by this point, and my phone dies, like right in the middle of this interview. Fortunately, I had like charged my backup battery the next day. So I run over my backpack, grab my battery pack out, plug it in, wait like 2 minutes, boots back up, call him right back. And we just continue talking about the movie. I remember in particular, it really reminded me a lot of Holy Mountain and El Topo, some of Jodorowsky's stuff. And one of the things that I think Panos really responded to was how I talked about, I love the devolution of the character of Red as the film progresses. In a way, the entire texture of the movie, the visual style, the sounds, because there's a lot of also sound stuff written into the script as well, how all of that kind of evolves and changes, and as Red steadily becomes less and less human, the more he gets closer to this goal of committing the ultimate revenge. And Panos really responded well to that. He was like, if you can come out to set to, you know, do a pleasantry and meet and greet, you're on board. And this has to be the absolute biggest coincidence in my entire life. Because on this commercial shoot, it was a traveling shoot. We'd been in Baltimore. We were had just been in Washington, D.C. And I shit you not, in 3 days, we were flying out to Berlin. And I'd never been to Berlin before in my entire life up until this point. They're like, yes, if you can fly out to meet us, you know, by the end of the week, you got the job. And like, well, buddy, you should say that. So I landed in Berlin, hopped the plane over to Brussels, met everybody, you know, exchanged pleasantries, and they gave me a shuttle drive, and that was that. And I started.
Amazing. So, like, in regards to Panos and Mandy, like, with the pacing of that film, how, like, kind of important was that? Because it's got this, like, I always look at it, it's this film of, like, two perfect halves, and it's kind of like you've got that beautiful centerpiece, which is the scene. And I'm sure if I say that, everybody knows exactly the scene I'm talking about in regards to Mandy, but, like, how important was it to Panos about, like, the kind of the pacing and that kind of, like, the kind of broken up into, like, the title cards and that? How early was that in, the script, or is that, did that come later?
Yeah. Also the pacing, extremely important. Mm-hmm. That Panos is a type of filmmaker that has the way a film moves, mm-hmm. the rhythm of a movie is just as important as who is cast to him. Like, it's, he has a very particular, he's attuned to a very particular frequency with the rhythm of the movie. And so more often than not, when I would show him an assembly of a scene, he'd be like, I have like two notes and it needs to be 20% longer. Like, I want these lulls. I want these super slow transitions. I the way this rhythmically, the heartbeat of this movie is so important and so crucial to the way he looks at things. And so that was in the film's DNA from the get-go. Like, it's as important to him as, you know, Johann's score. Like, it is everything to him. And we got to a point where, you know, this first edit of the movie, I think, was 2:45, maybe close to 3 hours. Wow. And we definitely lost some scenes to get it down in time. But I mean, there was a cut of the movie that Panos was ready to lock at 2 hours and 15 minutes. And this was like when we were in Brussels in the last few weeks of the edit, he was like, I would like to lock right now. And the producers and the team were like, please, like, let us show you a cut that's at 2 hours at least. And that ended up more or less kind of being the cut that exists today. So it's extremely important to him. And that being said, the two halves that you speak of were always that way. Yeah. He always had a very particular way that he wanted us to see Mandy. He talked to me a lot about how much more he associated and related to Mandy than Red. Like, he always found Mandy much more of an interesting character. And when Red does become your protagonist in the second half, according to Panos, he's just an extension of Mandy at that point. Like, he always found them kind of as like this singular character almost. Mm-hmm. In terms of the title cards, that Mandy card in the middle was always where it was supposed to be. Yeah. Or not exactly. It used to happen like right after, I think we had tried a few different edits where we had moved it around a little bit. I think initially in like the script, it was written into the script before he goes to Carruthers, before he makes the beast, before he makes the axe. Yeah. And then when we got to that, we're like, well, you know, if we put it, you know, after he visits Carruthers, where the momentum's warming up, we're learning about the Black Skulls, we're learning about the adversaries. And then we put it right after the axe being made, and you put it right before he's driving down the road in his pickup, like the momentum and the surge of energy that's going to build is going to be huge. So that's ultimately where we ended up putting it. But the other two cards, the Children of the New Dawn card was written in to the script as well. Yeah. And then I can't remember whose idea it was. It might've been mine. Two chapter cards felt like it was incomplete, like, at least to me. I felt like we needed a third one. And so then we kind of conceived this idea of having three chapters of the movies, mm-hmm. essentially. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, press out there and people say it has two chapters. I always envision it as having three. You have the Shadow Mountains, you're first chapter of the movie. You have Children of the New Dawn, when you meet the cult and you get the sense of adversary into their lives. And then, when it becomes Red Story, the Mandy title card.
What I find really fascinating about Mandy is that kind of like, there's like this weird blurring between what is like like almost like visual effects and what is editing. Like, I guess a scene that really sticks out to me is that scene where Jeremiah and Mandy's faces meld together. Is that a visual effect, or is that like kind of editing trickery?
It's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. It starts out as editing trickery.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of embellishments that have been done through that particular scene, so that face melding shot in particular, they shot that to be designed where it would kind of meld and flesh back and forth. And we had an early version of that where you apply this really long cross dissolves just to kind of see that it's working. You work the timing out and you get the shots and the faces where you want them to be. And then eventually we kick that off to our visual effects team, who really like tracked Andrea's face and her pupils in particular, so they would match up perfectly with Linus's. But there's a lot of other stuff in that scene, which is editing trickery. For instance, I think every single shot in that sequence is at 95% speed or 90% speed. I can't remember which one in particular. But we slowed every single shot down later in post. And then those, the movement trails, those blue elements that are left behind when people move, that is something that, Panos conceived and, we ended up doing in the last few weeks of the edit.
Amazing. So I guess, we need to speak about the scene, right? The kind of what I call like the earned Nick Cage freakout in the bathroom, that kind of like, explosion of grief. And it's like, I think Panos has spoke about it, that there's that scene's got a mistake in it, right? Like there's kind of, can you speak to that a bit more?
So the mistake to speak of, so we have two takes of this. Mm-hmm. I think I was going to go with the first take. Panos and Waller told me I was crazy. It has to be take two. And that's the film that's the reason I was like, well, take two hasn't aired it. And mind you, I was also so take two, there is an instance where he's going into his vodka stash. He pulls out the bottle and he's throwing things around out of this drawer. And he throws a towel that lands on the dolly track. Nobody noticed because you have Nick Cage screaming his heart out and giving this performance that no one clocks this thing. And so when he sits on the toilet and begins to break down, the performance comes much more inside and much more interior, the camera pushes forward and hits that towel that's on the dolly rack. And so if you are familiar with the film, you'll notice that the camera really isn't sure what to do at that moment. And that's because we can't fucking move any closer because there's a... So what they're doing was pulling the dolly back in the middle of the take. Someone rushed in, grabbed this towel off the dolly, and they continued the take and pushed back in. But Panos is that kind of director who's like, I don't give a fuck. Like, it's wonderful. Like, it's...
Yeah, it adds to the kind of, like, the anger and the kind of, like, do you know what I mean? The franticness of Red at that moment. So, like, it's those beautiful mistakes that kind of make that... And I imagine, like, it would take a lot out of an actor to kind of give that. Like, I'd imagine Cage wouldn't be doing 5-6 takes of that anyway, right?
No, typically not. On Mandy in particular, it's a bit different for Color and Pig. Mm-hmm. But for Mandy in particular, it was really rare if we did above 3 takes for Nick.
Mm-hmm.
It was a combination of, technically the Belgium crew was amazing. Very little resets needed for any kind of thing like that. But, Panos had a really good indication of what he wanted on the day. Him and Nick were aligned quite well in terms of what was going to happen. And so, usually they would get it in 1 or 2 takes and move on. And same with Andrea, for that matter, too. To this day, it's probably the film I have the least amount of coverage for that I've ever done. and that just, I think, goes to show, when... when you know what you want, and it's as because they had a respectable budget, they could have kept on shooting, but they know exactly what they want. And Panos is also that director who, you know, relishes in things being a bit gritty. He loves things being a bit dirty. I mean, I remember during the edit, he would talk about how one of the reasons he doesn't really like a lot of studio films is because they feel too polished, they feel too inauthentic, they feel too artificial, and there's no sense of a human element to it.
Yeah. Well, there's a beautiful like grit and a grain to Mandy that kind of like it almost feels like a film that like was made in the 80s somewhat, that like it's kind of like just been like the dust has been blown off and like you've like someone's unearthed, do you know what I mean? Like found it in the back of a video store and gone like, oh, how come nobody's ever talked about this? And it's like, I don't know, it's like a fascinating artifact of like, and yeah, like feels otherworldly as well.
He would be so happy to hear you say that.
I don't know who said it. Somebody said like an amazing thing once that like, it feels like a movie that's about like the roadies of like a metal band. When you see those metal bands who have like that kind of, I don't know, like fantasy imagery on the side of their like tour vans, like Red is almost like one of those roadies who works on, like is in that kind of metal world. And it's,
yeah. It's the movie is such an interesting combination of Panos's influences and things he saw when he was a kid. I mean, I remember him talking a lot about, you know, going into, you know, video rental places and seeing the horror art on movies he wasn't allowed to rent. Yeah. I remember there's another story he tells where he was in Mexico and he saw this Mexican biker pull up and just like do donuts in his front yard, and how like this clad image of this guy in leather, you know, just most punk thing you can imagine, and driving away really ingrained with him. So yeah, I mean, it's all a very interesting combination. And of course, you talk about Children of the New Dawn, and it's totally influenced by, you know, 80s doom metal. I mean, we tempt a lot of the movie with some really dark stuff. And then there's also a big love, like we use a lot of Brian May from Queen. We used a lot of Flash Gordon in that temp. We used a fair amount of Van Halen as well. Some of the instrumental stuff. So it's a very interesting mixture of all these different influences for this time and place in the world. And I don't know if I'll have the joy of working on something that eclectic and diverse and rich in terms of like its influences ever again. You know, barbarian movies as well. Like he, you know, he talks about Conan a lot, you know, during the editing process of this film. But it's a film that proudly wears its influences on its sleeve, whether it's, you know, classic 80s animation, or whether it's Jodorowsky, or whether it is
there's something that always stands out to me there, and I'm not sure if it's like from Panos or it's just a coincidence, but there seems to be like a Phantasm 2 like reference in it, like even the way that like Red is dressed, like in the kind of utility vest like type thing, and like especially the chainsaw fight, because I think like if I remember rightly, like a character Reggie ends up like with a chainsaw at the end of Phantasm 2. So like Don Coscarelli, and it very much fits that kind of 80s movie store aesthetic. Like it's one of those kind of odd films.
Phantasm, Hellraiser. Yeah. There's a Friday the 13th reference in there. I mean, this is all, you know, Panos's teenage years. Coming out, you know, kind of a petri dish of all of his influences coming together. That's all of that stuff is in there.
So in regards to like the films you work on, how often do directors tend to like, you always hear these stories that they say to like actors and stuff like that, like here's like a list of movies to kind of check out, this is, do you know what I mean, like this is what the vibe I'm going for, whatever. Do you ever get like a kind of anything like that, or are you kind of I don't want to know about like what's kind of influenced you, kind of?
Sometimes I ask first and foremost, just to, if they have any particular influences they want me to take a look at. I did a movie just recently called Werewolves Within, where the director really wanted to kind of capture this particular tone that you could kind of attribute or call a mix of a great, but classic Amblin, but also, some like early Coen brothers as well. Mm-hmm. You know, the eclectic rich of like all these different influences, you know, whether it comes down to a lot of the tempo and the camera trickery of Edgar Wright movies, like Hot Fuzz in particular, or whether it kind of has a lot of this charm and Ernst quality of like an Amblin movie, or if it has kind of the quirk and the eclecticness and kind of the character oddities that a Coen brothers might have, or that are well known for, you know, particularly like Raised in Arizona or some of their earlier movies. And so for that movie, that was a film that he's like, yeah, check up these films. And I watched a lot of those movies, you know, getting to work on that movie, you know, to get an idea for his taste, to get an idea of the sensibilities, you know, what's the tone, what's the vibe, what's the rhythm you're going for. Other films, not so much. You know, Pig in particular was a movie that Michael had, I think, one or two references he wanted me to look at. But that's a movie when you saw the footage, you were very aware of what it was. Mm-hmm. And same with Mandy. Like Mandy was one of those things where I think it was my first day. And I think my first scene, the first scene I ever worked on was actually a scene that got cut from the film. But it was really clear, at least to me early on, what this was. You know, this was something I could like tap into all that scary shit I saw on cable TV in my teenage years. That was like these old scuzzy 1970s, early 1980s movies that, you know, felt gritty, and just the texture of them felt so raw. Mm-hmm. And just the way it looked kind of frightened you a little bit, you know, whether it was the fog and the darkness and the wetness and the grain, it just felt destroyed. And you know, mix that with the performances and mix that with Cage's performance and the script, which was very evocative and very, very confident in what it was, you know, to a point where like, you know, you could read it and be like, this makes no sense. Like, but you know, fortunately, like I read it and I was like, I know exactly what this is. Mm-hmm. Or I think I know exactly what this is.
I'm going to move on from Mandy. Don't worry, Brett. But there's obviously one thing like I feel like I have to mention, which is the Johan Johansson score. And when did that, like, for you, like, what did you get to, were you privy to like any of the score whilst you're editing, or did it come after you'd kind of submitted your edit?
No, Johan was one of the first crew members that was hired on the movie. Amazing. Like I think after it was well before even me, Waller had worked with him on Mechanic, right before, Johan had come out with Prisoners. Mm-hmm. And so he already had that connection before Johan essentially kind of blew up. But Johan had reached out to Spectre when he found out about Mandy and Color Out of Space in particular. Like Johan really wanted to do Color, back when, the two of these projects have been announced. And I think, hopefully I'm right about this, but he was slated to like be the composer for Color as well. Hopefully I'm correct about that. I don't want the press coming or Spectre coming at me about that. So when I had started the director's cut with Panos up in Vancouver, Johan started out by saying there's three demos. One demo doesn't appear in the movie at all. It took a much more kind of Queen Brian May approach with it. One demo ended up kind of becoming the template for a motif that would occur later in the movie. I think if you're familiar with the soundtrack, it was called Dive Bomb Blues, or mm-hmm. that was the eventual name of it. And then another piece he recorded went into the movie as is. Panelists and I were like, this is perfect. And it was the piece of music that plays when Mandy finds the dead deer.
Yeah.
Like I think that has been maybe changed subtly since that first demo, but otherwise, you know, we threw that in the scene, we looked at it together, and I think Panos and I both made like kind of a mutual decision, like, don't touch it, it's perfect. Like mm-hmm. everything about this is the movie. And so from that point moving forward, like throughout the rest of the weeks of the director's cut in Vancouver to the point where we started doing the producer's cut over in Belgium, Johan wanted to say this stuff almost on a daily basis. We were a small movie, so we didn't really have a music editor kind of going in tandem. You know, usually you'd have a music editor kind of digesting this material, working with the stems, yeah. putting something in the picture, but that was all me. And so there's a good wealth of material that Johan recorded that never made it into the movie, that, you know, was like awesome and incredible, but is, I'm hoping, will be released one day, yeah. because he wrote so much for this movie that the public has not heard, it's not aware of. And, you know, panelists, the typical day would be panelists and I listening to these demos. And Johan would write some of the stuff sometimes without any clear indication of where it was going to go. And so it kind of came down to panelists and I being like, where do we put in this track? Where do we put in this? Let's put it up against picture here. One of the ones in particular that comes to mind is this big 80s gated drum track that eventually became the music when Red's driving from the chemist up until the children's range. That I think that was initially written without a clear indication of where it was going to go. It's only kind of in hindsight, I look at it right now and I realize like how special that was and how unique and beautiful these tracks were, because you're in post on a movie every single day. It's, you know, 12 hours of stuff and notes and revisions and music. Okay, cool. Throw it in. And not only in hindsight, you're like, that one of the better movie scores I've ever heard in my entire life. Yeah, yeah. And I wish I had more of an opportunity, you know, to really appreciate that when you're working on this.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a soundtrack I listen to, and hopefully, like you say, we get to hear that kind of those other tracks, even if it's in that 2 hours 15 cut that Panos met one day might get his way in release. So let's talk about Color Out of Space. Were you brought on earlier to that, or was it a similar situation?
I had heard about Color, because they had announced their collaboration with Richard on that years before. I mean, this was even before I think they'd announced Mandy. So it was certainly on my radar. I'd expressed, I think, interest to either Daniel or Lisa or Lighter. Someone there, I'd expressed interest about it. And they're like, yeah, don't worry about it. You'll be fine. And we were in post on Daniel Isn't Real when I found out that Color was indeed greenlit. And I think Daniel asked me as he was leaving the edit one day, he's like, you're doing Color, right? And I'm like, I wasn't even aware you're doing Color. Like, that's a go. And he's like, oh yeah, we'll set up a meeting with Richard. It'll be great. And I think 2 weeks later, I was talking with Richard on Skype, and kind of the same thing with Mandy. Just talked about, you know, how the script, what it reminded me of, my personal connection to it, how I felt about it. I think we ended up talking a lot. Richard and I ended up talking a lot about the creature itself, the Color, you know, the entire the alienness of it. You know, what does something sound like when it doesn't have vocal cords? How does it move? What is something this is? How do you do the story right? It's supposed to be something that doesn't exist on the color spectrum. Humans aren't supposed to see it. How do you make that into something that is a visual medium, visual and a sonic medium? Like, how do you pay that its due? And so I had a little bit of a hiatus in between Daniel Isn't Real, where I ended up doing Vigil, and then I jumped right on the Color after that and went over to Portugal to shoot it.
So how was that experience in Portugal? I know that Daniel Neri said to me, like, Sintra just seems to be this kind of magical place. He said, like, even I think there's a shot of a ring around the moon, and he's like, that's not a VFX. Like, that is real. Like, that's the kind of the mysticism and magic that's in the air in that place.
I wish more people knew that Color Out of Space was shot in Sintra, because you should go. It is one of my favorite places I've ever been. And it was such a nice experience shooting there and being there for the duration of that. We were set up in, for the unaware, Sintra is a very old town just outside of Lisbon, about half an hour. It's kind of up in the hills, this little small mountain area. So it's very moist. It feels very much like New England or even the Pacific Northwest, because it has a lot of fog, a lot of trees, big forests, and there's a lot of estates. There's a lot of old houses there from the Portuguese royalty and the aristocrats and it's well known now for being the source of the home of many palaces, in addition to a Turkish castle on top of a hill. And the typical day would be, you know, us getting into one of the production vans inside of Sintra at this beautiful little hotel, driving up these very wavy zigzag streets up the mountain, getting out. And the main Gardner house where we shot the majority of the movie is all one location. I think there were only maybe three or four other major locations that we ended up using, but almost everything else was like shot in this one spot. But Basecamp was set up in a building right next to the barn. So if you're familiar with color, if you know kind of the rough geography of the Gardner house on a hill, the well, and then the barn where the alpacas are, Basecamp was in a giant house, literally right, just right to the barn. So like if the camera was to like pivot and turn just like 15 degrees to the right, you see this big yellow structure, which is where we had our production offices, where we had our meals, where I was based. So I would show up, have a quick breakfast, go upstairs into this old mansion, I think built probably in the late 1700s, 1800s, definitely had that vibe, and begin working on the previous day with my assistant. Sometimes they would be shooting in the barn directly below us. I remember in particular the day where Cage comes in and shoots the alpacas. Mm-hmm. We have to do, 20 takes of that, three different angles, a close up, some inserts, so a wide, over shoulders. And so, every 5 or 10 minutes, I would hear that dependable Cage scream just downstairs as I was editing, because he's, he's literally only like 20 feet away from you as they're shooting this. And so you're trying to be quiet. And then, of course, you hear, bang, bang, you're like, just keep on working. This will happen for another 2 hours. What was a really good thing about this is that I could just throw a rough cut onto my phone and then go out to visit set and like show something to the producers, or show something to, more often than not, show something to Richard. Mm-hmm. And so I remember the day, like one of the days in particular, I was working on the finger chop scene, and I had come up with the idea to like, or the news to play a joke on Nathan. So I came up with this idea that, like, as he's talking about, oh yeah, I appreciate a nice bourbon out of Texas, I came up with this idea to put like bourbon connoisseur at the bottom of the Chiron. I was like, I'm so happy with this, so proud of this. And I took it down, and Richard and Waller were hanging out, and I showed them the scene like on my phone. And Richard's like, perfect, great, love it.
So what was the vibe like on set? I know that Cage has said that he was kind of channeling his dad, like in regards to that film. Like, was he very like taken away? Like, was he like kind of kept himself to himself, or was he mingling with all of you, having those meals around that table?
I mean, Cage is the kind of guy that he's a consummate professional. I mean, yeah. He will show up. He will clock in. He's the most, out of all the actors I've worked with, I've done 19 features now, he's the most gifted actor I've worked with. Like, he's the way he can hit his marks, the technical precision of this guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's the kind of guy, if you tell him not to blink for a minute, it's super easy for him just not to stare ahead, not move, not blink. Never forgets a line, never misses his mark. And yet you're still super excited to see what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. Never boring to watch. I don't really socialize with Nick, during the production process of a movie. He has his thing going, I have my thing going. And so he will, and there are some times where he won't even socialize with the other actors. I mean, there's when he was doing Mandy in particular, I'm not to go back to that movie, but like when him and Linus had scenes together, they would not interact at all. Like, to kind of keep that relationship cold and like save it all for the camera. So on Color, he was, I think, a bit more social with the other actors, I think Madeline and Brendan in particular. But he, he would show up, he would, would work, he would go back to his trailer for lunch, he would clock out, go back to the hotel, and then day and day and day again. Yes, he was, that voice, the affectation he does, the mutation that this alien organism does when it gets into you affects everybody else a little bit differently. And Cage had come up with this idea in tandem with Richard to have him devolve a little bit into his father, into this kind of, arty, narcissist, judgmental type. And so that, almost that voice, which a lot of people have incorrectly attributed to Trump, it's actually his dad. It's him falling into his real life dad, this voice that I used to hear, this judgmental voice that, you're not going to be good enough, Nathan, you're not going to be, et cetera. And he takes that on the more his character begins to evolve. It's a very specific choice he made as an actor with Richard. And, you know, we work on crafting that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more of that in the dailies. There were some even freakouts that didn't make it into the movie. You know, there are some lines we lost here or there because, you know, you're crafting this performance. And Cage, you know, being the actor that he is, he's always going to give you stuff that, you know, is surprising and stuff that is different. He's completely unafraid. And, you know, when you have a director like Richard, who is willing to, you know, let Cage try a lot of stuff out, sometimes he goes really far.
Yeah.
I think, did Daniel talk to you about the nose clip or like the hairpin on the nose?
He said he wanted the nose clip. And Daniel came up with, like, gave me the best analogy I think I've ever heard for kind of Cage's style of acting. He's like a garden hose that's like spraying water. And if he's with a right director, they know how to hold that hose and water their garden perfectly. Those nice ripe tomatoes. Or if the director's not up to it, they kind of just let that hose go wild and Cage will run.
That's a perfect analogy. Like that's great. Yeah. And you know, so there's a little bit of the director in that garden hose, then, so to speak, you know, a lot of that's on set. You know, I think out of like my three films of Cage, I think he explored more stuff in color in terms of like his range of performance than Mandy and Pig. And, you know, Richard would then calibrate that performance in on set. But then, of course, we get into the edit and there's further calibration that we do. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of, you know, although it makes sense, you know, in the context of that scene, you know, why, you know, Nathan would be evolving and going through these tandems. One of the things we kind of found in the context of that, you watch the scene, you edit the scene, you look at the dailies, you assemble it, you think this is great. And then you look at that scene in context and you're like, well, this heightened performance or how heightened the performance is right now just doesn't feel in rhythmic tone with the rest of its surrounding scenes. I think we should take them down a little bit, you know, or this particular freak out, let's, you know, really pull this back and save it for 10 minutes later when the freak out is a bit more justified.
Yeah.
You know, so for instance, you know, when he is looking at the tomatoes and the tomatoes are all tasteless and he's like throwing them around, we have a lot more stuff of that. You know, there's a lot more stuff of him freaking out, but like, you know what? He freaks out the appropriate amount here. It's strange. Jolie, the actress working against him in that scene, you know, is reacting in an appropriate way contextually, but we have to make it fit, you know, the other two scenes to make it feel like it's earned. But also, so, you know, four scenes later, after the organism has merged his wife and his son, that he freaks out in the car, that's a really justified freak out. Yeah. In the same way where you have you know, the vodka scene in Mandy, these things need to fit the story. They need to fit this anger, this, you know, burst of energy needs to fit the moment. It has to fit the character at this particular time. And sometimes that means refining and changing a little bit and, you know, kind of a give and take. And it's a little bit of kind of a secret relationship that the editor and we have with the actor. You know, we may never interact on set, but every single thing an actor does, an editor has looked at, they've touched, they've adjusted, they have manipulated. And if we do our job right, you won't even know.
Yeah. So one of the people I spoke to on this podcast about Car Out of Space is Dan Martin, who did the effects on this film, like the creature design and stuff like that. So what was it like kind of editing together those scenes? Especially, I think one of the most frightening scenes in this film is when Nathan is trying to shove his daughter into the attic with the kind of mother son mutant hybrid, like, because obviously that's a practical effect, right? That's somewhat puppet and like somebody in a suit.
Yeah, it's grotesque in a word. Like, he did a phenomenal job on that movie to a point where, you know, I would have to kind of take breaks looking at daily sometimes because I would feel a bit sickened. And mind you, that's also, you know, Julie Richardson, of course, you know, who's the actress underneath all this makeup, and also Julian Hillard, you know, also, you know, pinned to her as well in some of these scenes, you know, moaning and crying. And you can only look at that for so many hours. Yes. An audience member is only looking at that for an hour 50 or however long the movie is. But, you know, I would be looking at it for 10 hours a day sometimes. And you're like, I have to take a break from this. Because, you know, they would just, you know, some of these scenes require 10, 15, 20 takes, and they're doing it. They're bringing it every single take. And in conjunction with the Dan's work on the prosthetics, like it's this, everything kind of has to sing together and everything has to work and everything has to kind of vibe. And so, you know, a scene like, you know, when Lavinia is thrown into the attic and it slams the door and you have, you know, this creature running at you, you have to also kind of put your imagination cap on, because this puppet running at you also has, like, you know, four or five guys on green poles, you know, guiding this thing around. And you have to kind of have that vision of, like, what is this thing really going to look like when you remove a lot of the puppetry and you, what is that? You have to kind of envision that. And it even kind of came to a point in the edit where, like, Richard wasn't so sure on some of this stuff that I had included. I mean, there's one particular moment where at the very end of the movie, where they bust in and the our monster has, like, had completed the evolution. And there's a moment that kind of where they Ward busts in, the sheriff busts in, and Jolie lifts her head and screams. And Richard was convinced that was never going to work. He was like, I just see the actor, I see the makeup, I see the effects. And that was, like, one of the times on the movie that I politely put my foot down as, like, hard as I could. And I was like, Richard, I will take it out if you really want, but, like, this will fucking, like, this will destroy. Like, this is going to be so terrifying. With the right sound effect, when the visual effect is done, please let us, like, move forward with, like, this is a shot, because I think you're, like, this will blow your fucking socks off. And so it came up a few times where it's like, I'm not so sure about the shot. And I'm like, please. And we got to a point where we had agreed to, like, make it a visual effect shot. You know, let's include it. Let's send it off. And sure enough, we got it back. And I was very fortunate that I was proven right. A lot of times I'm not. Very often I am wrong in the editing process. At one point, I even propositioned cutting the Cheddar Goblin from Mandy, which I was very thankfully, in hindsight, overruled. And I look back on it now, I'm like, why are you saying this in public? People will never hire you if you say you propose cutting Cheddar Goblin.
That's got to be a big revenue stream for Legionnaire, right?
Oh my God, the way that character is taken off. But, you know, yeah, back to color. I mean, you're looking at these, you know, prosthetics, and as cool as they are, you're looking at the actor underneath the prosthetics. Yeah. And I think the thing that my favorite thing that about the work that was done was that you never lose sight of the actor's performance underneath. The Jolie and Julian are, their full performance is allowed to breathe and come forward, even when they're wearing, you know, they're caked on all this latex and makeup. And I think they did a phenomenal job with that.
So in regards to something like color, that's got a lot of, a lot of visual effects, especially when we get to that, like, final act and there's all that kind of crazy stuff that the human mind can't comprehend that we see and stuff like that. Is it like an element of, like, that stuff is happening, like, nice and early on? So, like, when it comes to it, you can edit it. Like, how do you kind of, or just wait till you get that, I don't know, hard drive dumped on you and you're like, well, let's edit this together in the rest of the film.
Yeah. That changes on a case to case basis with movies, you know, bigger budget movies. You know, I may just be editing. I may just be working with the material I'm given. And sometimes these are conversations above my pay grade. And I just kind of work with what I'm given. You know, this visual effects are already in the pipeline. They prepared this stuff. Color was a different situation, though, where, you know, we certainly had our visual effectists, we had a visual effects supervisor on set, but it became evident that we weren't going far enough in the edit with the amount of stuff, the amount of surrealism, the amount that the alien changes the fabric of your reality wasn't happening enough. And so one of the things we started doing in the director's cut was augmenting the environment more. So, you know, the foliage changing to magenta, for instance, was something that we came up with in the edit. That was something that I'd seen in look, like I was going over some of the lookbooks, I was going over some early artwork, and it had been referenced, but like no one had ever told me on set, hey, this is something we're going to do. Maybe it had been the intent to plan for it, but like it had never been like relegated to editorial. And so I started trying out all these secondary color correction options in the Avid to like generally gradually shift this thing more into the magenta space to get a sense that this thing is a contaminated environment. You have your sonic elements, you have this high frequency sound that's appearing at times to kind of suggest this thing is around you. But the gradual color change is something that we can, is something that we began to toy with and have temp versions of. Mm-hmm. Freak out at the end, like the house imploding and like the waves when you move a hand and you have that trail of motion that kind of sticks behind, the flashing lights, the camera shake. That was something, that was all stuff that I came up with, something that I pitched to Richard, something that Richard then was like, yeah, let's roll with it. Because Richard had never done a film with a lot of visual effects before. Yeah. And so this was kind of new territory for him where, you know, he, I think, was just becoming aware of the powers that we kind of had at our disposal. Mm-hmm. And mind you, you know, on other films, you know, adding new visual effects may be a no-go, you know, with the studio or the producers. But like, I think Spectre and Richard both agreed this is something that needed to happen. And we ended up adding a lot of visual effects to kind of get across that sense of degradation that alien, coming into this environment. And so a lot of that was stuff that I ended up doing temp visual effects for, you know, spitting out a shot under After Effects, doing a very rudimentary version, and then having that live in the Avid for a few weeks until it eventually went over to our visual effect vendors. And then the conversation becomes, okay, look at this very silly and rudimentary white blob that's moving from like screen left to screen right. That's the timing we want to have. This is a kind of a keyframe for how fast this thing moves. You know, notice how one of the things that came up a lot with our, you know, really experienced visual effect team was how often we wanted errors, how often we wanted, you know, imperfections in the image, which I think they were maybe a bit surprised at first to hear about, you know, because you spend all this money on a visual effect shop. Yeah. They're like, well, why wouldn't you want to see the alien? And then the argument becomes, well, because this is supposed to be an organism that should not exist. This thing is so powerful. This thing is so alien that you should be able to register it. So like, I remember in particular the actual merging scene where Benny and Julian or Brendan and Julian run out of the barn. Jolie picks up Julian and then the color overtakes both of them and they merge. You know, we had early iterations of that where, you know, it's just a magenta light.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had had a storyboard where there was going to be a bit more and we gradually kind of built up the energy, but it's like, this still isn't visceral. It should be horrifying and scary. And it never really worked until we got to a point where when this thing overtakes them, it's just blinding strobe light. It's we overexpose Jolie. We have all this energy, these flashing tendrils. And so it took a little bit of time, but when we got the visual effects team to see like, this thing should be so bright, so overpowering that it blows out the camera, that it shakes the camera. Like you have to pretend this thing is a real object. If you were shooting it practically, that it would be like being next to a fusion reactor, or it'd be like being next to a bomb going off. Yeah. Like it has to distort the image. It has to like, you have to lean into those imperfections to make this thing feel real. And once we kind of nailed that in the edit from a temp visual effects standpoint, you know, getting those boards right, that influenced everything we did later on.
Amazing. So again, this is a film that has another fantastic score by Colin Stetson. When did that like come to you? Again, was that a similar thing? Like it came in the edit, or was it kind of you submitted your edit and then Colin kind of scored to that?
This was a bit of an unusual, well, not necessarily unusual for, this was different from Mandy, I should say, where a lot of times Colin was brought on later in the process. But you know, sometimes what we do is we will spit out, you know, scenes or, you know, small moments to a composer. And sometimes composers will bid on a movie by sending you back demos. Yeah. You know, on Cooties, for instance, we were in talks with a few different composers before Crane came aboard. And one of the things that affected that decision were watching demos of, you know, early scenes with a score behind them. So with Call Out Our Space, for instance, I think Colin, he had known about this movie. He really wanted it. He started writing music, I think, before we even formally engaged with him. Mm-hmm. And so he was petitioning really hard for this job. And we had received demos from him that were honestly very similar to the final score. He had had a lot of these ideas to merge sound design and score, where the identity of this color, the motif of the color, would be almost like this coral reef, like these really high frequency, static-like particle sounds, which are actually, it's a coral reef, in conjunction with a lot of other avant-garde elements in the score, like he has elk calls in there, he has cranes, there's a lot of animal elements in this. And so it really came down to him and another artist. Then Daniel and I would be in the edit, and, you know, looking at some of these things, and it kind of became down to, you know, which person is going to be. And the team eventually landed on Colin, because we brought in his music. We put it up against the very end of the movie, that scene where Ward is up against the dam and he's looking out and he's giving that, you know, the famous H.P. Lovecraft, you know, final words of the short story. And we put up Colin's score against that, like an early iteration of that scene. And that's eventually what we ended up. That was kind of the clincher. That was the decision.
Yeah. It's another perfect marriage. And Colin's music's beautiful. I think I first heard about Colin from, of all places, Bad, Bad, Not Good. I think he features on their fourth album or something like that. A saxophonist. So let's talk about a project that day of release is released today, well, at least in the US, and it is Michael Sarnowski's Pig.
I'm looking for a truffle pig. Someone stole her.
What are you thinking?
I remember every meal, every person. You live your life for them, and they don't even see you. We don't get a lot of things to really care about. Who has my pig?
So it's probably a good thing that I played the trailer just then, because it's kind of a question I've had, like, kind of in the back of my mind is, obviously when you edit a film, I guess the trailer then is edited by like a marketing team at like the distribution company. So how does it feel for you as an editor? Like, do you ever feel like when you see, like, whether it's your film or other films, you're like, oh, that's not how I would have done it. Like, take Pig, for instance. When you saw the trailer, do you think it kind of sets up the film that Pig very much is?
That's a great question. There are oftentimes I see early trailers that I despise, that I think don't capture the tone of the movie at all. We had an early version of a trailer from Mandy when we were going to AFM that I think didn't capture the tone of the movie at all. It kind of leaned in and made it seem very silly and didn't capture the tone of it. Pig, we had also seen a version of a trailer for AFM or a sales market that made it seem quite silly. And the creative team and I were like, this doesn't seem appropriate for this movie. And Michael, the director, even, you know, drafted up a very politely worded memo and was like, we want something that leans away from the genre tropes, because the audience is going to be assuming this is going to be John Wick with a pig. Like, on the page, you know, the type of movies, a lot of movies that Nick puts out these days, you know, are going to put an audience in a position where they're going to assume it's a knockoff. Yeah. And, you know, on paper, it's a silly premise. You know, it's a guy going into the city to rescue his truffle pig sounds silly. But the film is not silly. It's not a silly movie. It is, I think, far more grounded than both Mandy and Color. It's a drama. Yeah. Which is, I think, going to be a huge surprise to a lot of people. There are, I think, some surreal elements in there. There's some weirdness. But I would never describe this film as a genre film to an audience, which is why, like, I get a big chuckle when I see, you know, genre sides like Bloody Disgusting, like, you know, putting out a thing for it. And I'm like, this has far more in common with like an A24 drama or a Neon drama than Red Central or one of these things. Like, there's maybe one or two moments of, like, you know, fright in this, but like, there's almost no blood in this movie. There's nothing that I would quantify this as an action movie at all. And so it's been such a when you see early trailers sometimes that try and sell a movie like that, it's a bit disheartening, because you're like, the thing that makes this film, one of the things that makes this film special is Cage's involvement. And also that this is a very different film than a lot of films he's been putting out recently.
Yeah.
It's very much stands apart from like a lot of this other stuff. And I think audiences are really curious to see a movie like that with Nicolas Cage showing everything he can do. Because this is, I think, a far different performance than people are expecting him to give. You know, this is not a Nick Cage freakout movie. This is not a Nick Cage meme movie. This is him tapping into something that I don't think people have seen since Joe, or yeah, tapping into even something earlier than that. Like, this is, I didn't really know what to expect from him when I got my first day of dailies. But I was extremely gratified and happy to see the decision that him and Michael chose with the character, because it makes perfect sense. And without giving in the spoilers, like the way where he goes with it, it gives you this entire cathartic emotional ride.
Yeah, so I believe I heard in another interview, you were raised in rural Washington, right? Like, kind of.
Yes, I was. Yeah.
So was this film somewhat for you like going home? Do you know what I mean? Like coming home, because obviously this is set in Portland, Oregon. Like, I'm getting mixed up with, but like, do you know what I mean? Like that kind of rural aspect, just away from it. From a town.
No, it does. It feels very similar to where I grew up. And even the film points to like at the Seattle-Portland rivalry at one point.
Yeah.
But it's one of the things that reminds me so clearly is just like how dark everything is in the forest. You go out in the Pacific Northwest forest in the fall or the spring, and you get an overcast day. It is so dark and so dreary and wet, and it's dripping with texture. And I think that's one of the really remarkable things about Pat's cinematography in this movie is like how perfectly he captures that. It is the texture of moss and how green and wet everything is. It just felt very much like a trip home for me, because that's where kind of my backyards.
I count it like, I kind of, when I was watching it today, I checked in at like, I think I looked at the ticker and it was like, we've gone 6 minutes in this film. There hasn't been like a single word spoken. Like, again, like, I don't want to give away too much, because obviously it's been released day and date of the film. But again, is this a film where like pacing was very particular from Michael, or was it kind of like to get that tone? It feels like a very reflective film.
Yeah. No, I mean, pacing was extremely important to Michael. Not as much to the extent as a director like Panos in particular, but I mean, the first cut of Pig we had was close to 3 hours.
Wow.
Pig was a movie that came down a lot in screen time. The first cut was very big. We ended up losing a fair amount of scenes. I would probably say half a dozen scenes. And a lot of scenes have come down significantly in their final length from, you know, where they were written. But we got into an interesting scenario where, you know, this first cut, you know, Michael would see, you know, these transitions, and kind of how I go about the early stage of the director's cut is that we go kind of on a chronological basis in a linear fashion, hitting, you know, scene one, scene two, scene three, and just allowing the director to work with me, get a sense of the material, put their finger on the pulse of the movie. And Michael's early ideas were to really slow everything down, you know, not completely dissimilar to Panos. And so his first director's cut, like that first director's rough that we had, you know, like 3-4 weeks after he started this cut, was even longer. It was even longer than my assembly. And then we ended up watching that down. We're like, this movie is 3 hours and 15 minutes. Let's start looking at this thing now, maybe contextually. Let's think about like on a scene, instead of like a scene by scene basis, let's think about like in sequences. So, you know, looking at the first sequence of the movie, basically everything up until Pig is abducted, treating that as, you know, one story thread.
Yeah.
How much of this do we really need? How much can we compress? And when we got to that point, Michael was, you know, eager to try out different tempos, different rhythms, some alternative structural things. We got to a point where I think we were into a week at the first cut. We each other producers, they had proposed doing some small restructuring in the beginning to make it seem like there are more, there was like more than one story day occurring. So in the early iteration of the cut, it just starts off with, you know, Cage and Pig going into the woods, finding the truffle, Amir coming, and then they make a truffle and they go to bed. One of the first things we did when the producers came on was to make it seem like there were two story days happening. So we did some small restructuring, changed some pace things in there. And then that comes down significantly in running time. You know, suddenly the section that was, you know, his pig wasn't kidnapped until, you know, 25, 30 minutes in his early iterations was now happening, you know, like 15 minutes in, give or take.
So I'm trying to tiptoe around this film, and it's like there's a thing you said about it, like not being like John Wick. And again, I don't think this gives away too much, but one of my initial...
I'm down to spoilers too, if you want to do spoilers.
Maybe we'll chuck some in at the end just for those people who want it. But like, I found the third act probably has more in common with something like Ratatouille than it does with John Wick, and the kind of the way that the story progresses. And like, and you mentioned like, obviously there being a much longer cut and scenes running longer. One scene that really stood out to me, and I think it's like perfect the way it ends, is Amir in the mirror and that kind of like pep talk he's giving to himself. Was there a lot of that? I imagine there would have probably been a lot of that scene.
There was a fair more amount. And what's fun about that scene is that like, that's actually, that contains an Alex screw up where he decided to reset in the middle of the take. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, wait, that seems like a mirror, like just talking to himself and then, you know, breaking down, then talking to himself again. Yeah. That's actually Alex, I think, like getting out of character and getting back into character. there was one of the wonderful things I think working with these two actors was how much, Alex really was inspired by Nick.
Yeah.
And when it's after working on two Cage films and seeing Alex's footage, you know, it's really interesting to then see Alex, you know, almost like a protege of Cage in a sort. You know, he's making a lot of these decisions and trying things out that, you know, Nick Cage did, you know, 20 years ago, you know, with these shifts in energy and bursts and momentum and rhythm changes. But, you know, and it was really exciting and really cool to see that. Certainly there would be takes where you have a lot of variation, where, you know, he would go really big and then small, and then Michael and him would try and find it together, which was different, because in most of the cases, the other two movies I worked with Nick, you can have a lot of Nick variation. Mm-hmm. Nick would try out different energy reads, you know, with Richard or with Panos. And this is a movie that Nick very rarely shifted from the tone of the performance he was giving on take one.
Yeah.
Like him and Michael had worked something out. They worked out a backstory for this character and worked out a cadence for this performance that very rarely shifted. And when it does, it's surprising and shocking. And it's almost like a dormant volcano. You know, it's like this, you get like little earthquakes, but nothing on the exterior kind of changes. Maybe you get like a really intense flicker or stare, you know, exuding screen charisma. And then he goes from this, you know, silent hulking type to this flash of energy in a split second. And then he's back down. He's back into his contained self, back into this, you know, super dense black hole.
Well, one of the things I found, like, especially watching them in quite close succession with Mandy and Pig, is obviously they both utilize the kind of like almost like free act thing of like the title cards. And like, they also both center around like this kind of key scene in the middle that kind of like is like a switch in it. Do you know what I mean? Like where, and in Pig, it is that moment where him and Amir go to the restaurant, the kind of like the hot shit restaurant in the middle of Portland. And it's, you get like you're saying, like you don't get anything big and brash from Cage in this, but you somewhat get this kind of like, very measured and considered, like visceral takedown of this restaurateur that is just like a beautiful like centerpiece to this film. And it's kind of it's so great to like, I don't know, speak to you, obviously having worked on something that's got this burst of anger and energy and violence to this film that is very like down. But again, I imagine there's like there was probably so much more of that as well, right? Like
Honestly, not a lot. That scene in particular stayed pretty close. We ended up losing a little bit. But I mean, even from a script point of view, when my agent sent me the script and he was like, I don't know if this thing is for you. And this is before I knew Nick wasn't even involved. I had a suspicion, like looking at the lookbook, I was like, there's a lot of like Rob, or there's a lot of Joe photos in this lookbook. I had a suspicion that they're thinking about Cage for this. It was at that point when I was reading the script, I was like, I'm 100% in. Like this, it was my favorite scene in the script. It was my favorite, to this day, my favorite scene in the movie. Because like you said, it's that crucial midpoint of the film where Rob decides to rely on somebody else. Like yeah. Rob decides to rely on Amir to help him at this point. And he would have not been able to go into to the chef and talk this guy out without his help. But you also have this screen charisma, this power kind of exuding off Rob in the scene. And he's doing so much by restraint, by control, by holding things back. And those last few lines of the scene in particular, where Rob stares down the chef and he's, yeah. He's pleading with him, but also intimidating him, but also kind of shaking him down. He's doing all these things at once, you know, begging this guy, but also trying to strong arm him into by humiliating him in his own restaurant, mm-hmm. saying like, saying more or less, you're a sellout. You sold your soul. None of this matters, you know, hitting him with this wave of nihilism, but there's only one thing that matters. It's taken from me. Where is it? Mm-hmm. You know, this is something that matters. None of this matters. And Cage just nailed that take again and again and again and again by just the amount of restraint and control over his physical performance was extraordinary. Like, yeah. I think I mentioned this earlier. I've worked with a lot of actors. Nick is one of the only actors I've worked with that just feels gifted. That feels like there's something else at work that you can't train, that you can't practice, that there's something else there.
Yeah.
And that scene completely showcases it.
Yeah. Like, have you ever gotten from an actor, like a kind of like, has an actor ever reached out to you and said like, hey, thanks, you made me like, do you know what I mean? Like, not that they would look bad in the film anyway, but like, hey, you made me look really good in the edit of that. Or do you know what I mean? You managed to find.
Yeah, they have. I have, Elijah's done that with my experiences then with Spectre, with Cooties and stuff. Karen Gillen, who I did Parties Just Beginning with, she's been very generous about her praise. Milana from Werewolves Within just reached out, and said a lot of nice things. Cage and I don't have a personal relationship,
yeah, yeah.
But we definitely know of each other and very appreciative of one another. We were at an event for Colorado Space for a Legion M or some kind of a Beyond Fest premiere or something like that at this theater in Los Angeles. And they were doing a Q&A with Richard and Cage and Patton Oswalt. And this was like right in the middle of like, we're editing Pig in my apartment, which is like a 10-minute walk from the Vista. And so like, Michael and one of our producers, Vanessa, you know, come to the Colorado Space screen with me. And then I think, you know, Patton had like mentioned Pig or mentioned something at one point, and Nick just has the microphone. He's like, yeah, I just want to give a shout out to my editor, Brett Bachman, who I'm doing Pig with like right now. And I think he did a bang up job on color. And there was a public screen that they were doing a live webcam on, and he totally went out of his way to do that. And it was for that acknowledgement was extremely generous, and I hold that memory very close to my heart.
Amazing. So yeah, with Pig, there's I don't know, like one of the I think the thing I find fascinating about it, and it is it acts almost like there's a meta narrative to the film that about Nick Cage himself, of this kind of like, especially I don't know if I'm kind of looking for this with somebody who's done a podcast looking at every Nick Cage film, but like the story of Rob is very much similar to an extent of Cage, of this thing of like, there was a period of Nick Cage's career in somewhat that he was out in the wild, that, like, do you know what I mean? There was a time when the name Nick Cage meant something. Do you know what I mean? Like, summer 97, it's Con Air and Face Off. And then the 2010s, it's like, became that meme, that kind of guy that people, I don't know, like, you're getting sizzle reels, like Nick Cage loses his shit and he's somehow like a punchline to a joke. and I just find it fascinating that there's a film about a truffle hunter looking for their pig that seems like it's more of a meta conversation about Nick Cage and his career somewhat than possibly a film that is an actual meta film. Obviously, like, nobody's seen it yet, but like, he's in a film coming out next year that he plays himself. Yeah. So it's like that thing of like, but yeah, like, do you kind of pick up on, like, maybe not that fit, but like the kind of, like, the themes of a film, are you kind of finding that in the edit, or are you kind of like, yeah, is it like, do you find the film in the edit, or is it kind of a lot of them, the directors know what they want from the off?
Ooh, that's a great question. Where to start with that? that's an interesting point about the meta narrative in terms of, like, Rob, the truffle hunter, or the famous restaurateur who's now a recluse in the woods. You know, how do you compare that with Cage's career? Can you make a comparison to Cage's career? And I'm going to kind of toss that back out to the jury. I don't know.
My reading of it.
I love that kind of film analysis. On a day-to-day basis, we don't think a whole lot about that in the day-to-day process of editing the movie. We certainly talk about the themes. We certainly talk about the things we want to convey with the central ideas that you want to express with the movie, because you have to be very, especially, you have to be a storyteller first and foremost. I mean, yes, you're selecting material, you're selecting takes, but you have to be a storyteller. And I am of the opinion that the editor has to be as gifted in story as much as the screenwriter. Yeah. So, you know, for any, you know, burgeoning editors listening, I would say, instead of reading a lot of technical books about the Avid and about types of cuts, read screenwriting books. Just read books on story, read books on character, read books on transformation and arcs. That's going to give you 9 times out of 10 more of a clear head when you reach a dilemma in the film editing process about what to include versus what not to include. So we talk about that stuff all the time. Yeah. You know, on Pig, a clear example on Pig would be the scene before you were to see, the scene before he goes into the restaurant. There's a scene where he goes to a house.
Yeah.
And he goes to the house and he sits with a little boy that he meets us there. And this particular scene was on the chopping block for a little bit of time. And, you know, the creative team, we weren't really sure what to do with it. And at the end of the day, the reason it was kept, or at least my argument for keeping the scene, was because it was one of the more foundational points of Rob's arc. And that'll make sense, you know, once you have a full context of the movie. And, you know, if we can get into spoilers, I can talk more about it. But you need that scene to understand why this character, what he's really up against.
Yeah.
What he's really up against. Like, you have the entire, you know, journey into going to recover the pig in Portland is an exterior facade for what's really going on.
Yeah.
Like, yes, he wants his pig back, but like what the character needs versus what the character wants are two different things. The going in for the pig is just kind of that shadow puppets. It's not what the movie's really about. Mm-hmm. That scene where he goes to that house and he says to that kid, that's the first genesis of him working out the conflict that really matters. Mm-hmm. Why the movie, hopefully, if you like it, actually has emotional resonance is because of that interior character story and that what Rob is really going through. And that is one of those scenes that, you know, we look at from like a story theory and we're like, this is what the scene does. Yeah. It may, you think like it's a 3-minute scene, not a lot happens in the scene, from like, you know, a small point of view, but you look at that scene on like a greater structural thing and like what it represents on Rob's journey. I was arguing, I think it's extremely important because it's his first step. It's his first step to completing this arc. So we definitely talk about those kind of, you know, thematic decisions and story through lines, but in terms of, I think leaving how to interpret a movie in terms of its, you know, place in the world, or, you know, its meta narrative or whatever like that. I think that, it's impossible to predict that. We kind of leave that to the audience.
That's left up to the nerds like me. Yeah. Well, like, shall we get into some little bit of spoiler territory? So anyone who's listening, if you haven't seen the film, duck out now. Because there's, one of the moments that really like I think is great in this is there's a moment towards the end which will have, if this were John Wick with a pig, it would be getting the guns ready, boom boom boom, getting all the stuff ready, and instead we get this beautiful montage of Cage and Alex making dinner together, which is beautifully like shot, like wonderfully edited. Like I love like the kind of like you get the mirroring of Cage doing something and then you get like Alex doing something like that. Like I think that's beautiful, and like again, was stuff like that, was that found within it? Because you said like the original cut of this was like 3 hours long. It was a lot of
We certainly, you work with that material, you look for those kind of things. And so in a way, is it made? I suppose, because a lot of it's, you know, a cool shot effect. A lot of it's, you know, looking at, you know, juxtaposing two shots that, you know, and you infer a narrative or infer a meaning out of that. Yeah. And a lot of it's, like you said, nonverbal. So yes, it requires a lot of us in the editing to make sure that story is told when you don't have the, you know, dialogue doing that. You know, all the subtext has to be in body motion and camera and sound and music. You know, that entire end scene, you know, from the point they agree to team up and they go to the bakery to the point where, you know, Darius tells him the truth. That's all nonverbal. Not a word is said. I mean, all that is body language and performance and acting and editing. But no, none of that was really found in a typical sense, because the movie always knew what it was going to be. Yeah. This is a film. Sometimes you get into a film where you do a lot of restructuring, you know, you move scenes around, you know, your last scene is your first scene. And I've done those kind of movies. They can be a lot of fun. And sometimes they don't work out all that well. Sometimes they turn out great. This was a movie that very little changed in terms of its structure, in terms of its overall placement of scenes. We changed a little bit at the beginning, yes, but this was always a film that was about friendship. It's about loss. It's about friendship. I have no idea why people are thinking this is a revenge movie. Like there is absolutely no revenge in this film at all.
Yeah.
Like it is, like no one has like, yes, someone has taken his pig, but like Nick isn't chasing down, you know, mobsters or people in the film world with weapons to, you know, avenge his pig. It's, he's trying to find the one thing that gives him happiness in the world, because this is a story about a man that has chosen to run away from society because he was broken.
Yeah.
And you learn why he was broken throughout the course of the movie. And so the entire movie in the story hinges on this question of, can a broken man face loss and begin to rebuild himself? And facing the loss is, yes, his pig was stolen, but he's in the woods because Lori died. He's in the woods because his wife died. You know, him facing the trauma is facing the fact that his wife is dead and she's never coming back. And the pig being taken was just a catalyst for all of this. Mm-hmm. The true thing, him being able to kind of come back into society, being able to trust people again, and take that initial step to entrust Amir, someone that he was very reluctant to have any relationship with, forced to have a relationship at the beginning of the movie, he appreciates at the end as a true friend. And the movie hinges on that. Like the movie, all those elements there have to hinge on him entrusting this character that begins to see him as kind of like a role model, kind of like this mentor figure, and have this mutual appreciation for one another by the very end, where, you know, Nick used to think he was some kind of spoiled rich kid, and then he discovers why he is the way he is. And then Amir, you know, begins to appreciate why this weird guy was out in the woods when he learns about Lori and he learns about his past and, you know, what he chose to run away from because he was so hurt. Like that is why the movie has power, in my opinion, is these. And that was always in the script. I mean, Michael and Vanessa really wrote a really beautiful, really touching movie that is, I think, going to surprise a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it couldn't be farther from bacon or all that stuff. And as much as I'm relishing, like, you know, people like discovering this, I can't wait for, you know, a point, hopefully in a few years down the line, where all those comparisons are completely forgotten.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I've kind of like figured it out whilst, like, especially look at the films you've edited of Cage's, you've somewhat like been involved in a Nick Cage trilogy of like Man of the Woods Cage, where it's Mandy's like kind of living out there in the middle of nowhere. You've got Color Out of Space. Obviously, the Gardner family live out in the middle of this woods, and then Pig. Like, it's a kind of that's a great little trilogy to be a part of, right?
Oh my God, someone might write a paper about it one day. I guess you're right. Yeah. I mean, my fiance and I, she was joking the other day about how much you could actually like make a comparison between Mandy and Pig in terms of just like on paper, you know, like the loose archetypes that you find in that movie, mm-hmm. you know, loner man out in woods, you know, living with, you know, something that he is affectionate with. And then they're both a recluse from society. And then one day, you know, said object is taken away from him. Yeah. And so he makes the grudging decision to go back and re-engage with his old identity about who he was. Yeah. Okay. I can see it.
Yeah. Well, they're both explorations of grief as well.
And yeah.
That's kind of the key at the heart of all of it. Like, obviously people are listening, like if you're in the US and you've listened this far, go out and see Pig. Like, it's fantastic. I could talk about it all day, but I'm cautious of taking up your time, Brett. Thank you so much for coming and getting caged in with me. It's been an absolute blast. There's so many other things I had down on my notes. I'd love to talk to you, but like we'd end up talking for hours, and that's no fun for anyone.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And there we have it, guys. That was my conversation with Brett Buckman, all about Mandy, Color Out of Space, and Pig. It was a great conversation, right? There was some amazing things. As I said in the intro, there's some things I'd never heard about. I never knew there was more Johan Johansson music for Mandy. Let's hope that one day we get to see, or that gets to see the light of day. I'm sure if you're like me, you would love, love, love to hear it. As I mentioned in the intro as well, other episodes to check out if you enjoyed this one, if you're new to the podcast. I'd really recommend that one with Daniel Noah. Really recommend the conversation with Brian Taylor, director of Mum and Dad and Ghost Rider, Spirit of Vengeance, as well as my interview with Ken Sanzel. You really get to see how lovely Cage is, as well as Todd Farmer as well, the writer of Drive Angry, and Marco Kyrus, Nicolas Cage's stand-in from 1994 to 2005. That's the level of guests I interview on this podcast. If you weren't already aware, this is the premium Nicolas Cage podcast. I'm gonna be arrogant and say that I'm very proud of what I'm doing here. And yeah, I can assure you there are some great people lined up to speak to in the future as well. If you enjoyed this episode, please, 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 please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. If you'd like to get in touch, please do so on all the social media. So that is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd, all at CagedInPod. Or you can always drop me an email at cagedinpod@gmail.com. So as always, I have been Petrus Patsilivus. I have been caged in. Until next time, keep it cagey, and I'll see you then.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.